being with a client until he was taken away to be shaved, to be hooked up to the electric chair, to be executed. And to be with him those last hours of his life was pretty tough. I will have to say he was helping me more than I was helping him to deal with it, I think. But you just have to take the good with the difficult.
Every raindrop reflecting on the water as the sun shuts her eyes. Don't know what you'll uncover. Watch the tide rolling with the moonlight. Everything is silent on this Louisiana night.
We are here today with Rebecca Hudsmith, who is a federal public defender here in Louisiana. Hi, Rebecca.
Hi, good to see you again. How are you doing?
Good. Thank you so much for joining us. And we were hoping we could start by asking about what's it like to be a federal public defender? What is your typical day? What happens?
Well, the thing that makes this work so fascinating is there really isn't a typical day. You never know what call is going to come. And it could be from a court or an associate saying, we need your help. This person has been charged or arrested, and they have to be brought to court in a timely fashion. And we need you or someone in your office here as soon as possible. But to make it even more complex, I'm the federal public defender, meaning the head of the office. Everybody in the criminal justice system in the federal courts wants the defendant to have a good, competent lawyer. This just makes it work for everybody.
What types of cases and clients do you typically handle?
We're responsive to what the Department of Justice does and what the prosecutors, the U.S. Attorney's offices bring. And that's determined by who the Attorney General and the President are. Now, under one president, the priority, like under President Trump, was immigration, charging for immigration violations. Under our current president and Attorney General Garland, it's violent crime, which it always is, stopping violent crime on the streets, but also civil rights violations. People say, how can you represent those people? I say, well, first of all, they're people. They're not just one thing. And they're not just defined by the one awful thing they may have done. And they have family and stories of their own, often filled with abuse, including childhood abuse. In terms of the types of cases, generally speaking, there's always drug conspiracies charged. Not like simple possession, but, you know, bigger drug conspiracies that may cross state lines. So something you would expect the feds to pursue. Child porn, which is internet, again, across state lines. Bank fraud for a federally secured bank. We've represented people on the Air Force Base in Treeport and the Army base in Leesville who've committed crimes there. We've represented somebody who they were farming oysters in an environmentally banned oyster bed. I've worked on environmental cases where a company was, instead of properly storing their waste, their barge waste, they were throwing it in the Mississippi River. But I would say mostly in addition to the drugs, illegal gun possession cases, a felon in possession of a firearm cases, and then a fair amount of what I call fraud, whether it's Medicaid fraud, you know, business people who are not following the rules, mail fraud, wire fraud, what we call white collar in the business. Back in 2000, I spent 4 months in trial with Governor Edwin Edwards and his team of lawyers. I was appointed to represent the single person of all the defendants who needed court-appointed counsel. And that was an extortion licenses for the riverboats. People were paying people off, according to the government's theory, including Governor Edwards and my client and others, to get those licenses because they were a finite number and they were very valuable. And, you know, there you go. That encourages people who are greedy to do the wrong thing. I have argued before the United States Supreme Court representing a young man at Angola State Penitentiary who got in trouble. And I've had people who never, ever before in their lives strayed, not even run a stop sign. And one night, one moment, one wrong decision, and their whole lives change. And they're like, I don't understand. I'm like, well, the good news is we've been fighting even for the worst of the worst to make sure the system works for you as well. And that's what I try to explain to people who often don't understand what we do or criticize it. I mean, I've had people send me hate mail before, back when they mailed things. I mean, I've had actual hate mail saying, I can't believe you do what you do. You're awful human being. But I represent underrepresented, mainly women, I hate to say it, but with gambling addictions or even spending addictions. And that leads to taking a little money from your employer and it adds up. Before you know, you can't pay it back. And then you get caught and there you are. The person who's been there for 20 years, the most loyal and most underpaid employee there, who was there every day, but in a bond for your family, you did something wrong and you have to pay for it.
What type of cases for you stand out strongly in your memory looking over your career?
In private practice in Shreveport, I did some really great civil rights stuff. You know, represented a woman who was on a crew, the only job she could get after her husband left her, and this rural parish working on the roads. She was the only woman, and you can imagine the sexual harassment she suffered from. And we ended up going to court, and of course, all this stuff came out, all these mean letters, and the judge ruled in her favor. Such a great victory for her as a woman who was just trying to do a job and pay her bills and support her family. I represented some guys who opened a gay nightclub in Bossier Parish. And don't ask me why, but they did. And it was right on the Bossier Strip where the Cowboy store was and the Methodist church. And needless to say, it did not go well. And they got in trouble for the least little things. And I ended up representing them before the Bossier Parish governing body. And it was quite an experience. And, you know, they ended up able to reopen their business. It was all technical violations and opened a lot of eyes to the people on the governing body that these were nice guys. You know, they were gay guys and it was okay with them creating an environment for their audiences. And then beyond that, the 4-month trial with Governor Edwards was humongous with international and national press from all over the world there all the time from every major news outlet and magazines writing stories, mostly about the trial. And it was intense. The lawyers, the hired lawyers, of course, were high-powered, expensive lawyers. And so I learned a lot from them. It was a great experience. And then arguing before the U.S. Supreme Court was pretty cool, you know, to go there. My mother came to watch. And my best friend from Washington, D.C., from my old firm was there. And you know what was really neat? These students at this high school in like somewhere in New York State, they drove to the court to watch me argue. They had adopted my case as one to follow, their high school civics class. So I sent them all my briefs. I answered some basic questions, you know, couldn't reveal any strategies or anything confidential, but I told them basically about the case and they studied it in their class. And then they came to the U.S. Supreme Court and watched, and it went really well. Afterwards, the professor comes up, I hadn't met them in person, and he comes up and he says, my students want to talk to you. So we went out to the lobby of the U.S. Supreme Court and I was surrounded by these young, eager students, you know, who were talking about what happened, what it meant, what they thought. I mean, it was just icing on the cake of a wonderful experience to have that class there following me and getting hopefully so much out of it. That was really cool.
That's hard to beat.
I have had an unfortunate experience of being with a client until he was taken away to be shaved, to be hooked up to the electric chair, to be executed. And to be with him those last hours of his life was pretty tough. I will have to say he was helping me more than I was helping him to deal with it, I think. But you just have to take the good with the difficult. And I tell people, you know, they never really taught us some practical aspects of practicing law in law school. It was all theoretical, but they surely didn't teach us, you know, how to be with a client who's about to be executed. So that was pretty tough.
I guess I would like to know, too, you mentioned having cases that are difficult to defend. How do you separate your own beliefs and opinions from your client?
It's not a struggle because I see what my role is. You know, if I can't do it, I should have another role in the criminal justice system, but I can do it. And I guess, like I say, it's that little social worker in me, not that I'm a trained social worker by any means, but it's that part of me. One time I was in front of Judge in Alexandria, a federal judge, in his conference room. We were talking about a case that had come up, and I don't even remember exactly what I said, but I said, Judge, just look at it this way. From my client's perspective, poor thing, blah, blah, blah. Awful childhood, which many of our clients have. I mean, really awful. The horror stories. Oh, poverty, addiction, whatever it is. And he just needs to be given a break. And the judge, who knows me very well, he looked at me, he said, you absolutely were meant to be a public defender in the federal criminal justice system. I'm like, yeah, I guess so, you know.
As somebody who's kind of had the ability to look on and see maybe some trends over time, the media tells us it's terrible. There's violence everywhere. Everything is horrible. Mm-hmm. And we should panic. What's kind of your perspective to that?
I don't see that in our cases. I think those trends are overblown, maybe because of the craziness of the pandemic. There was a rise in violent crime because of everybody sort of going crazy. But I have not seen any indication of those sorts of trends. What changes over time is what is the drug du jour that's out there? You know, back years ago, it was crack cocaine. Crack cocaine is going to, now don't get me wrong, I hate drugs, but crack cocaine was going to destroy the world. And so we've got to give them 100 times the penalty for powder cocaine, which meant all of our African-American clients who didn't do the white rich person's powder, but the cheaper crack, went to jail for, I mean, we had clients with life sentences. A lot of those clients, by the way, got pardons to reduce sentences under President Obama. He did a big pardon clemency push before the end of his administration. And a lot of, again, pro bono attorneys worked on those cases for a lot of our clients. You know, I had a client who he goes to state court for drug possession, crack, in his poor neighborhood, where if you're going to make money, that's it. And if you're going to have a vice, that's it. And he gets time served, possession with intent, because he can't afford bail and he gets out. That's his way of getting out. Happens a second time. And he's a drug addict who has very little involvement in the drug trade because nobody trusts him because of his addiction. So again, arrest, can't afford bail, literally doesn't have a pot to piss in because they won't let him in the house for fear he'll steal something, has to sleep on the front porch. Time served, gets out. And then a big drug conspiracy involving anyone who ever touched any cocaine distribution or possession in that poor Black community. Huge conspiracy. He gets wrapped up in it. And third strike, you're out, life. And there's nothing that can be done unless he can cooperate, and he can't because he doesn't know anything. So people like that, I mean, you're just pulling your hair out. How can this be? Even the judge, even the prosecutor said there's nothing I can do. So then it's people like that a lot who got, after serving, by the way, maybe 15, 20 plus years, got some relief if the prison record was good under President Obama. And so they got penalized for what they did. They served time, but, you know, it righted the wrong of that harsh overreaction. And now it seems like all the talk, and this is a very serious drug, is fentanyl. It remains to be seen. There's certainly all sorts of talk about the same thing. Everybody gets a life sentence. And sometimes we do that. We overreact to what is really a societal problem that needs to be dealt with treatment and just so many things.
Speaking of fentanyl, have you heard of any use of Good Samaritan laws just for people calling in ODs without any kind of repercussions because it's such a crisis right now?
I have not. We showed this film that really opened my eyes, y'all. It was about Freetown, a documentary. And the big deal was they said, we all have Narcan. If you live in Freetown, your job is to have Narcan and use it and know how to use it and use it appropriately if you see somebody in trouble. And so that's a lot of responsibility to put on a community. But they really were like, it's a tight-knit community, and that's, they're doing that even if no one else is, you know, even if the city or the parish or the whatever government entity is doing it. These individuals who care about their fellow, their neighbors, and understand that that's just out there, do that. It was really eye-opening for me. Very interesting.
No, and that's so interesting. I'm definitely going to look for that film. It leaves us to our next point. I want to talk a little bit about your involvement with Cinema on the Bayou and any films or projects you're working on.
I remember we got a film about Herman Wallace, who is at Angola, and it was called The House That Herman Built. And it was just a beautiful film. And a guy who'd gotten out of Angola came, and the artist came, and what a great discussion with the audience. And then we've shown films, like a film that some folks from Mississippi submitted about this guy who pretended to know about teeth. So there were all these innocent people on death row or in prison based on his fake science. Recently, however, was Andrew After Angola. And that one, the best short, we have juries who review the films and we give out awards. We give out awards made by Pat and Andre Juno, a fish. And so they won for best documentary short. And it's about a guy who, when he was 15, killed a girl who was 15. And they had been out together and something happened and just lost it. And I don't know all the different details of the crime. Because he was a juvenile, he got juvenile life. And then the Supreme Court changed the mandatory juvenile life and said you have to consider something less than life. You can still give life. And so the judge reconsidered the mandatory life as required and gave him life with the possibility of parole. And then he ultimately got paroled and he started a group in Baton Rouge. They help long-termers in Angola who are seeking parole, but you know, they've lost touch with family. They have no money. They have no help. And so that's what he's doing now. And he was there at the film along with the filmmaker. It was really a great audience discussion. And then now Point Noir is the name of the film that Pat Muir and I wrote together during the pandemic. It's about a Cajun man on death row who is falsely accused. And he's at the end of his appeal, no more appeals, no more habeas, no more anything. And so this woman lawyer in New Orleans who's done death penalty work agrees to take on his representation before the pardon board and the governor to try to get clemency. And she goes back to her hometown, small hometown of Point Noir on the Cajun Prairie, meets up with a documentary filmmaker there, and they work on the case together to figure out what happened 30 years ago. Point Noir stars Roy Dupuis, who is a very famous actor in Canada.
I do have to say something about Point Noir. That name is so interesting because my dad's family is originally from this small community outside of Church Point called Point Noir.
And that's what it's based on. What's your family name?
Janice.
Ah, yes. Well, see, Pat Muir's father is from there. So ours is a fictional Point Noir, but it's a town on the Cajun Prairie like the real Point Noir.
I can't wait to see this film. I'm so excited for it. Thank you so much.
It's going to be
such
good.
A pleasure.
I love the questions. I love what y'all are doing. I haven't listened to all the podcasts, but I've listened to some. I really like what y'all are doing. Please keep doing it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
If you like what you hear, go subscribe to Missing Magnolias Now, wherever you get your podcasts.